Welcome to Sunday Homilies with me, Father Mike Schmitz. I hope today's homily inspires and motivates you, and I also hope that it leaves you hungry for the one who gave everything to feed you. If you want to get this and other Sunday Mass resources sent straight to your inbox, sign up at ascensionpress.com/Sunday or by texting Sunday to 33777. You can also follow or subscribe in your podcast app for weekly notifications. God bless.
The Lord be with you. A reading from the Holy Gospel according to Luke. Chapter 15, verses 1 through 32. Tax collectors and sinners were all drawing near to listen to Jesus, but the Pharisees and scribes began to complain, saying, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." So to them he addressed this parable. "What man among you, having 100 sheep and losing one of them, would not leave the 99 in the desert and go after the lost one until he finds it? And when he does find it, he sets it on his shoulders with great joy. And upon his arrival home, he calls together his friends and neighbors and says to them, 'Rejoice with me, because I have found my lost sheep.' I tell you, in just the same way, there will be more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous people who have no need of repentance. Or what woman, having 10 coins and losing one, would not light a lamp and sweep the house, searching carefully until she finds it? And when she does find it, she calls together her friends and neighbors and says to them, 'Rejoice with me, because I have found my lost coin.' In just the same way, I tell you, there will be rejoicing among the angels of God over one sinner who repents." Then he said, "A man had two sons, and the younger son said to his father, 'Father, give me the share of your estate that should come to me.' So the father divided the property between them. After a few days, the younger son collected all his belongings and set off to a distant country where he squandered his inheritance on a life of dissipation. When he had freely spent everything, a severe famine struck that country, and he found himself in dire need. So he hired himself out to one of the local citizens, who sent him to his farm to tend to his swine. And he longed to eat his fill on the pods on which the swine fed, but nobody gave him any. Coming to his senses, he thought, 'How many of my father's hired workers have more than enough food to eat? And here am I, dying of hunger. I shall get up, and I shall go to my father, and I shall say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I no longer deserve to be called your son. Treat me as you would treat one of your hired workers.' So he got up and went back to his father. While he was still a long way off, his father caught sight of him and was filled with compassion. He ran to his son, embraced him, and kissed him. His son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I no longer deserve to be called your son.' But his father ordered his servants, 'Quickly, bring the finest robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Take the fattened calf and slaughter it. Then let us celebrate with a feast, because this son of mine was dead and has come to life again. He was lost and has been found.' Then the celebration began. Now the older son had been out in the field, and on his way back, as he neared the house, he heard the sound of music and dancing. He called one of the servants and asked what this might mean. His servant said to him, 'Your brother has returned, and your father has slaughtered the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound.' He became angry, and when he refused to enter the house, his father came out and pleaded with him. He said to his father, 'Look, all these years I served you, and not once did I disobey your orders, and yet you never gave me even a young goat to feast on with my friends. But when your son returns, who swallowed up your property with prostitutes, for him you slaughter the fattened calf.' His father said to him, 'My son, you are here with me always. Everything I have is yours. But now we must celebrate and rejoice, because your brother was dead and has come to life again. He was lost and has been found.'" The Gospel of the Lord. Man, I've been wondering about this. What would your perfect life look like? I don't know if you've ever thought about this. Like, what would your picture of a perfect life have in it? Imagine that there's some things that you check the box off, like, you know, if you want to get married, like, I want to be married. If you're called to be married, I imagine having a perfect life would involve being married. But not just, you don't just have any kind of marriage. You want to have the kind of marriage where you're, you know, like, you marry someone who's just a little bit more attractive than you. So you know you won in that whole thing. Like someone who may be a little smarter than you, someone who's a little bit nicer than you, like I'm winning all over the place. Like, you know, when you have kids, you don't just want to have kids. You want your kids to be healthy, right? You want your kids to be happy. You want your kids to be holy. Yeah, there's things like check these boxes. If you want this perfect, what's your ideal life look like? If you're not called to that, maybe you're called to be a religious sister. Like it's not just any community. It's like this kind of community. And if you're called to be a priest, it's not like any parish. It's okay. I want to be at the cathedral or whatever. You know, that sense of like, I imagine we all have these images, these accomplishments, these achievements we would want for our perfect life. And that's fine. But for your life to be perfect, how long would it have to last? Because I don't think we think about that. I think if we're living for these achievements, we a lot of times live for the resume, right? We live to pad that resume. And we say, I want to do all these things. I want to accomplish all these things. The question is, I think sometimes we don't even think about is, well, how long would it have to last for it to be perfect? Could you live the perfect life in 50 years? Could you live your perfect life? Could you live the perfect life in 30 years? Could you live a perfect life in 25 years? Just getting everything just right. I was talking with a woman on the phone not too long ago. She was recently diagnosed with cancer, and it's a serious cancer that will likely end in her death. And in the course of our conversation, she wanted to connect. She wanted to like get some words of faith, some words of encouragement. And so I brought up that fact that my mom has been diagnosed with cancer that will ultimately kill her as well. And this woman, her response was really unique because she wasn't rude. She wasn't angry. She wasn't dismissive. But her response was, well, yeah, but how old is she? Because I was saying, oh, my mom is at peace. My mom is like ready. She wants to see the Lord. And this woman's response was, well, yeah, she's at peace, but she must be like 20 years older than me. And again, she wasn't being rude, just a normal response, right? Because however old we are, we're like, well, if someone got more than me, then of course I would have peace in my life too if I had 20 more years. But is that what's needed? Is that what's needed for the perfect life? Just more time, like more time to pad the resume, right? More time to build up the resume, more time to live the perfect dream, to live the perfect life. I came across this quote from a woman. She reflects on scripture and she teaches. She said this. She said, I used to live life afraid that my life wasn't going to work out just right. I don't know how many of us here in church, that's what we're living life. Live my life afraid that it's not going to work out just right. Perfect. We have to ask the question, what are we doing with this life? If I want more time, why? Just for more accomplishments? Just for more achievements? Just for more experiences? Just to build the resume? Or am I crafting a life? This is the big question. Am I just padding my resume, or am I crafting a life? You know, we started this series a couple weeks ago. This is the third part of this series we're going through called Eulogy Virtues. We realized that so many of us, we live for the resume, right? We live to build the resume, but we're left with the eulogy at the end of our lives. We live to build those resume virtues, but we are left with those eulogy virtues. And we've been talking about this now because I think when it comes to those eulogy virtues, when it comes to that, like that person I want to be, that person of character, a lot of times we think, well, that's how I'm going to be later. That's who I'm going to be later. But I have this news. The news is who you are now is who you are. You might not realize how profound that is. That's really profound. Who you are now is who you are. Like who you are now. If you were to die today, who you are now is the version of you that will be remembered. You are not yet whoever you will come to be. Who you are now is who you are. What would they say at your eulogy? A bunch of years ago, well, not too long ago, they graduated in 2019. There's this group of young women on campus. One of our missionaries, her name is Tracy, and Tracy had a Bible study, and these two girls, Laura and Sarah, came up to her and said, Sarah and I want to be part of your Bible study. We realized we've been coming to Mass. We realized we have to take that next step. We have to, like, we need to be surrounded by sisters. And so Tracy brought them into her Bible study. I remember when I first met them, I'd seen them at Mass, but I was over at the Women's Missionary House, and I walked in, Tracy was having a Bible study, and Tracy's like, okay, you know, this is Mariah, and this is Carly, this is Sammy, this is Maddie, this is Sarah, and this is Lara. She said, Lara, like that. And so for weeks, I thought that this girl named Laura, her name was Lara. And so I was like, who's that girl named Lara in your thing? And this doesn't have anything to do with anything, but just so you know, her name's not Lara, it's Laura. Okay, so here's this group of girls, and they're at this Bible study. And it was one of those things where Laura, not Lara, every one of those girls would say that one thing you need to know about Laura in college and after college is Laura was full of joy. Like her life is marked by joy. And that's the eulogy virtue I'm going to talk about tonight. Joy. You know, the last 3 weeks, we talked about humility the first day. We talked about loyalty last week, and today is joy. Humility, it's really interesting. I don't think very often we recognize humility when we see it. We sometimes recognize loyalty. We always recognize joy. Joy is so attractive. And that's the thing. They describe Laura. They were like, oh my gosh, she would draw people to herself. She'd be so not just animated, not just ecstatic, but there's something about her. You know what joyful people look like, right? We know that joyful people are the kind of people that you just want to be around. And they say, Laura, that's who she is. That's what she was like in college. That's what she was like after college. And joy is so interesting. But what is it? This eulogy virtue of joy, it's so powerful, it's so compelling, but what is it? I mean, it's in the gospel today, right? Here's the shepherd, rejoice with me. Here's the woman, rejoice with me. Here's the father saying, we must rejoice. So joy, so powerful, so attractive. I think all of us want it. What is it? Here's a very simple definition for joy. Joy is the abiding sense of well-being. So joy isn't being ecstatic. Joy isn't necessarily bouncing off the walls. Joy is the abiding sense of well-being. Yes, it can be a feeling, but it doesn't have to be. Joy is a choice. Joy is a decision. But here's the tricky thing. You can't get joy by choosing joy. You have to get joy by choosing something else. Because joy is a consequence. Joy, another way to say it is joy is a fruit. Joy is the fruit of our focus. Basically, where we look will either bring us joy or sadness. Where we choose to focus will either bring us joy or sadness. That's why the opposite of joy, right, is sadness. What's the cause of sadness? Some people think that our cause of sadness is suffering. Sometimes we think that our cause of sadness is our circumstances. That's not true. Both joy and sadness are the fruit of our focus. I'm going to go back to this. You might think tonight that the source of sadness is suffering or our circumstances. Because although obviously those are real, right? Suffering is real. Circumstances that break our heart, absolutely, those are real. But if that's the case, then many of us can never experience joy because our circumstances will always involve suffering. And that can't be the case. Because if we're called to enter into joy, it's got to be something more than just our circumstances. It has to be based on something more than just our suffering. I would say this, the source of our sadness is not suffering. The source of our sadness is selfishness. Another way to say it is the source of our sadness is suspicion. Think about this in your life. Think about anyone you know. Everyone you and I know probably, if they're a sad person, if the sadness permeates their life, they're probably someone who's suspicious. They're probably someone who can't bring themselves to trust. You know anyone like that? They don't let themselves trust. Because you know, we need trust in order to love. You need trust in order to love. If we don't trust, then we're always going to be suspicious. And if we're always suspicious, then we back away from love. We need trust in order to love, and we need love in order to find joy. Because technically, joy isn't actually a virtue on its own. It is a fruit. It is the consequence of having been loved. The origin of joy is love. It's even in the gospel today. The shepherd says, rejoice with me because I found my lost sheep. There's a reason. There's a source. I love this, and I found it. Rejoice with me. I found my coin. Rejoice. We must rejoice. Why? Because your brother was dead, and now he's alive. The source, the origin of joy is love. But think about this. Think about the younger son as he comes home and his father's ridiculous about him. His father is overjoyed about him. And he says, basically, come on, come. The younger son, he comes home ashamed, right? He comes home shameful. He doesn't come home as someone who won. He doesn't come home as someone who's had victory. He doesn't come home as someone who can be proud of himself. He comes home as a failure. He comes home as a disappointment. He comes home as a tragedy. He has ruined everything. And what's his father say? You failed. Be clothed. You've fallen. Be fed. You've made a shipwreck of all of it. Be celebrated. You have nothing to be proud of. Be loved. How many times have we escaped joy because we refused to be celebrated? How many times have you and I eluded joy because we refused to allow ourselves to be loved? We refused. Like, no, I'm too broken. I'm too far gone. You can't celebrate me. You can't see me. You can't love me. So in 2019, Laura and these girls in her Bible study, they graduated, but they made a commitment. They said, so Sarah Swafford was on campus last Thursday, and when they were students at UMD, she was on campus as well. And Sarah said to them what she said to us on Thursday night. She said, okay, you need to find a tribe. Like, if your goal is heaven, then you need to find a tribe of girls or tribe of guys to run with, to strive after heaven with. And so they said, okay, we want to go to heaven. We need each other. So they kept their Bible study going. It's one of those remarkable things. That's what the whole point of having these studies are on campus, is not only so you have girls and guys to strive with on campus, but afterwards. And so they called themselves the Strive Tribe, because they were like, we need to get to heaven. We can't do it on our own. So every Tuesday night, regardless of where they were, they come together for their Bible study. And I talked to one of the girls, and they're like, she's like, yeah, it's hard. It is tough. Like, in college, all the free time in the world. You might not believe me, but it's true. After college, no free time whatsoever. These Tuesday nights would show up, and they're like, the last thing I want to do, I'm so exhausted, I'm so busy, I'm so stressed, I don't want to go to the Bible study. But every time they did, they showed up, and they were surrounded by these women who were